This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, indeed, this is The Deep Dive, and I am Brooke Spector, your host. And as we do pretty much every week at this time on Friday morning, we bring you a conversation with a guest who is interesting, a guest who has ideas, a guest who informs, a guest who can explain, a guest who gives us an insight into the rest of the world rather than just our own little closeted selves. And as a result, one of the people I often wanted to think about having as a guest is an old and dear friend, Barbara Masakela. Barbara has a fascinating personal history. Obviously, she is South African by birth. She went to the U.S. For study that became a prolonged exile, and she ended up teaching at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And as far as I can tell, she chose to live in New York City rather than in New Brunswick, New Jersey, which is probably a fine choice. And in New York City, she was in the heart of the cultural and intellectual ferment of the 60s, 70s, the 80s, and on even into the early 90s. Then she came back to South Africa, where she did a stint, and where I got to meet her. She was the African National Congress's lead person, spokesperson on cultural issues. And that was particularly important in the first couple of years of the 1990s. And then for her, sadly for us in a way, but good for her, she moved over and became one of the key figures in Nelson Mandela's office just as he was becoming president. So that was quite a leap. And eventually, she became South Africa's ambassador to the U.S. and went back to America representing a very different country than she had left. I have been keeping up. I run into her every once in a while in bookstores, which is sort of the obvious kind of place where we would inhabit each other, where each would inhabit. And she has published one volume of her memoirs, and I gather she is now working on volume two, finishing it up. And I hope that brings us up to through her time in the U.S. As South Africa's ambassador. Barbara, welcome, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Brooks.
I want to understand, how did you get to America in the first place? Obviously, it was to leave South Africa and the circumstances at the time, but why America and how did you get there?
I first went to America in 1963. No, I left South Africa in 1963. I went to America in 1964. I had left South Africa to go to Ghana. And in Ghana, I got ill and I went to the UK for medical treatment. And I was in a facility called Harefield Hospital for about 11 months. And during that time, my brother was in the United States and he was married to Miriam Makeba. And while I was in hospital, they took care of me and came to see me. And it was obvious that when I recovered, I had to be taken care of. So I went to live with them in New Jersey, just outside New York, in 1965. And that's how I got to America the first time.
When you say your brother, we should clarify for audience members, that's the other Masakela, who is well known, and that's, of course, the musician, composer, recording artist, musical superstar, Hugh Masakela. And Mary McCabe probably doesn't need much of an introduction from me either. There you are in New Jersey, and you're out of the hospital, you're living with your brother or you're living nearby. You went to study, and which university were you studying at?
First of all, I think we have to set, I had a baby, my son, Babusha, in 1965, August. I had a son called Mabusha, who is alive and kicking still. And Miriam was obviously at the height of her career. Hugh was making his presence felt. And we lived, guess what, opposite Dizzy Gillespie in New Jersey. Dizzy Gillespie was our neighbor, and they were very, very lovely people.
That's quite a street.
Among the things that happened during that time was that, of course, there were always lots of South Africans, not lots, but there were always South African students in the United States. And Miriam Makeba had just completed an album with Harry Belafonte, where she used all the students who were in New York and in the surrounding areas to sing with her on the record. Yeah, it was a great time. And of course, Harry Belafonte was on. We would go and listen to the playbacks in the recording studio, and Harry Belafonte, Jonas Gwangwa, Hugh Masekela, all those people would be there. And there are many, many students. And already Miriam had made a great name for herself, not only from the point of view of singing and being an entertainer, but she was a very, very astute political anti-apartheid, you know, person. And she had spoken at the UN already to the General Assembly, sponsored by the government of Guinea. But there was very, very little about South Africa in the United States at the time. Very little. And I remember that there was only, it seemed to me at the time, that there was only one person who would from time to time write about apartheid and and against apartheid, and that was Anthony Lewis, who was a correspondent for the New York Times. I think of that period as a time of great loneliness, because it was before the anti-apartheid struggle became, you know, such a huge calling for many people, before also it was on the cameras. It was also a time when the Cold War, what was called the Cold War, was still very much in force. So to a large extent, the African National Congress was viewed as a communist organization of terrorists. And we had no, there was no, we had no representation at the UN. It was a very, very lonely time. I remember that as a student, I registered as a student at Fordham University. And I remember that sometimes for a whole day, I wouldn't speak to anybody, or nobody would speak to me, because I knew nobody. And it was also, I think people ought to remember that it was also the time of the civil rights movement, you know. A lot was happening all over, and we were reading in the papers about you know, the demonstrations by the students, etc. It was also a time of the Vietnam War, and there was a huge anti-war movement at the time. And yeah, so it was a very, very special historical period, because it was also, I would say, an opening up of the United States itself to other ideologies. It was a challenge to the long-held ideas of state that that the United States had had. It was also the beginning, I think, of the feminist movement in the United States. So it was really a very exciting period, of course, which was also marked by decolonization in Africa and in Asia. So it was a great moment in history.
We're speaking with Barbara Masakella, who probably needs little introduction. This is Brooke Spector and The Deep Dive, and we will be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and our guest this morning is an old and dear friend, Barbara Masakella, who was, among other things, long list of things, among other things, she was South Africa's ambassador to the United States a number of years ago. She was the cultural spokesman for the African National Congress in the 1980s and early 1990s. And she was an indispensable part of Nelson Mandela's office. And she's writing her memoirs, and we're walking through her history and the way in which she ran into America. Now, you were studying at Fordham, but eventually you moved on to teach at Rutgers. Am I right?
I was studying at Fordham. And also, I noticed that you forget that I was the first woman appointed to be an ambassador. And my first station as an ambassador was in France. I studied at Fordham for a term, but it was a very unhappy period in my life, personally and otherwise. And I couldn't stand it. You must remember that there was very rampant racism in the United States of America, whether you were in the Deep South or whether it was considered a little better in the eastern coast of the United States, and New York was viewed as the leading liberal area, you know, in New England and those places. But for the most part, racism was deeply, deeply entrenched, discrimination against Black people. And as an African, it was also a time when the ideas of Black consciousness in the United States were seeding and beginning to sprout. So it was the era also of the Black Panthers and so on. Angela Davis came to the fore. So it was a hot period. And of course, it was also a great rock and roll time in terms of music, you know.
Mm.
Music was, and people in the United States were beginning to understand that the United States was not the be and end all of culture. So African music was coming onto the scene. So for instance, the Guinea Ballet, I don't know if you remember that, was usually an annual thing at Carnegie Hall. And it was a huge, huge event to see Africans in a more than an hour long production, you know, playing the kora. So the world was opening up in general. And I think it was not only waking up to Africans, but Africans were also waking up to each other and to the Asians and so on. So anyway, I was at Fordham, and one of the courses I was taking was an introduction to anthropology. Mm-hmm. And the professor was a Catholic monk. And I was deeply, deeply offended by him, by his choice of words, by his attitude. I felt like an outsider. I was an outsider. And each time he referred to primitive society, which he did, I don't know how many times in a lecture, I just cringed because I knew that it was directed at me. It was just unbearable. It was unbearable. And I heard that there was a fund at the United Nations, a scholarship fund, and that in order to get this fund, you had to go and study in Africa. So I jumped at it, and one day I took my baby and put him on my back, and I walked to the United Nations and asked for the office against apartheid, and I went straight there and applied for a scholarship, and they said to me, Will you be willing to study in Africa? And I said, of course I'll study in Africa. So I got a full scholarship from the United Nations, and I duly went to the University of Zambia to study there. So in 1967, I left the United States and went to Zambia to study. It was the university had just been established, I think, maybe 2 years before. And I think, as everybody will remember or not remember, Zambia had just gained independence in 1964. Yeah. So I went back to Africa. So I've always been drawn to the continent, and I went back there.
Obviously, you came back to the U.S. and you ended up at Rutgers.
Well, I studied at Zambia. Then I went to Los Angeles because, yeah, I don't want to get into all my personal stuff here, but I had a car accident and I was badly injured. So I had once more to go to my brother, who had always been there for me. I went to recover in Los Angeles in 1960. Let me see. And I was a year short of my degree because I kept on failing a subject they called scientific approach. Somehow I couldn't dissect dead animals. I just couldn't dissect an animal, and it always ended up with blood all over. And I just could not pass that subject. For 3 years, I failed it. But I was getting straight A's in all my other subjects. So anyway, to cut a long story short, I went to the United States, and through that is where in Los Angeles at the time, that where I met Lindiwe Mabuza, the great woman poet and anthologist and ANC activist. And she was teaching at Ohio University in Athens at the time. And she persuaded me to go to Athens and complete my degree. And that is where I went, and I got my degree cum laude in 1971, I think, yeah. And then if I may just give a short, since you want my CV, I want to talk more about ideas than my CV.
Please do. Let's do that.
Very important to me, because in Ohio, that is where I discovered African American studies.
Uh-huh.
I went full force into that, and a whole new world opened up to me, because we had all studied about slavery, but it was usually in a very cursory manner. And I had never been as close to African Americans as I was, because in Ohio, in Athens, because I went to school with them, et cetera, et cetera. And I wish I could remember the name of my professor in who headed the African American Studies, but I don't. But anyway, it was a huge, huge, a very important discovery for me, the whole African American Studies issue. And I think it changed my whole consciousness, and it strengthened my political resolve. And in Athens, Lindy and I were talking to everybody about apartheid. We were very active in that. And altogether, it was a spurt of intellectual and emotional growth for me in Athens. And I met there one of my professors at the universities was a man called Quincy Troop. Quincy Troop was in the African American Studies Department, and he was teaching literature and poetry. He's a great American poet. And Quincy Troop had a creative writing class of which I was a part. And I started writing poetry under his tutelage. He subsequently moved to New York. And it was through him that I moved to New York, and I continued with my writing, and I got a job at Staten Island Community College. And it was from Staten Island Community College that I moved to Livingston College at part of Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And as you will recall, again, this was a time of the burgeoning of Black Studies departments in United States. It was part of the civil rights movement, part of the changes that people were fighting for in the United States, that particular attention was paid to African-American students who had not had a good high school education and could not enter university. And I was part of that brigade that did the bridging teaching of students, you know, into like introduction to literature, you know, effective writing. So I taught all those things at Livingston College for 10 years.
What were the books that challenged you most, what were the books with the most energy for you?
You think I can remember titles? I remember that. I will remember this because very recently I organized my second Johannesburg Festival of Women Writers, and I invited Margaret Busby to be our keynote speaker. Margaret Busby is a British publisher and anthologist. She did Daughters of Africa and New Daughters of Africa. But anyway, it really ought to be on everybody's bookshelf, because it's a lovely reference that shows the absolute talent of African women, or let me say women of African descent, who have been writing since early times in Egypt. You know, it's a wonderful textbook. It's a reference book to have. Yeah. But anyway, I'm talking about Margaret because one of the books that really influenced me was a book called The Spook Who Sat by the Door. And I've just discovered now that she was here that, in fact, that book had been rejected by so many publishers. And Margaret, as a young student, that was when she first started her publishing career, she published that book, The Spook Who Sat by the Door, and it became a world bestseller. Do you remember that book?
I do. When I was asking you the question, I was thinking about beyond the obvious names for myself. And there is an author by the name of David Bradley, you may be familiar with. He did an important essay about Alice Walker, just as she was reaching yeah. her own fame. But his yeah. novel, the Cheneysville Incident, which is all about memory and recovery and forgetting and re-remembering, mm-hmm. you know, family histories and stories and secrets, which had been recommended to me by a colleague who, for the purposes of this discussion, is also African American, and he said, "You must read this book." And then he ended up coming to Japan, where we hosted him for lectures to young wow. academics who were also interested in African American literature, and in particular yeah. African American literature by women. So the circle is very large. I'm going to have yeah. to break for a second. This is Deep Dive with Brooke Spector, and we're speaking with our old friend, Barbara, friend of long standing, not old friend, Barbara Masekela, and we'll be back in just a minute.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and my guest this morning is Barbara Masekela, proponent
of... Well, you know, I'd really like to dwell a little bit. You know, that is when I also, I mean, obviously the great standard then was Ralph Ellison, the invisible man. And I remember that was the first time I read that book when I was doing my year at Ohio University. And I was just blown away. I had never read anything at that like that. But another thing I must say is that Quincy Troupe invited quite a number of major African-American writers and poets. God knows, I can't remember all their names now. But, and I remember that one of the people who came to, that Quincy invited was a woman called Toni Cade Bambara.
Oh, yes.
Who became a very, very good friend of mine. Quincy introduced me to her, and it was through Toni Cade Bambara, who was teaching at Livingston College, that I was able to get a job there. Unfortunately, she passed away at a very young age, but she had a wonderful mind, and she was a very, very, very courageous woman. But I also met people like Ishmael Reed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Who is quite, what shall I say, he's not your run-of-the-mill African-American writer. You know, he's got his own approach to literature, which some people consider as kind of maverick or whatever. But anyway, yeah, I met many, many, many writers and poets there. And so when I moved to New York, it was natural because also my job at Staten Island Community College, Quincy had taught there. So he recommended me, and that's how I got that job, and then subsequently moved to Rutgers. And then I went back. I went back later to Ohio to do a master's degree. I took a sabbatical because I had been teaching at Rutgers for almost 8 years. So I got a sabbatical and I went to study for my master's, and I did all the coursework and passed my examination, but never did a thesis. I never completed the thesis. And that's the story, my academic story.
Well, you could always turn in your memoirs as a thesis.
Well, much, much more than that. I think I've made so many speeches. You know,
I've
written so many speeches. I've made so many presentations. And right now, I mean, I because of the memoirs, I'm a writing fellow at the University of Johannesburg. At the Johannesburg Institute of Advanced Studies. Yeah.
I didn't actually meet you, but I first encountered you in depth, I guess, when you gave a speech at the Grahamstown National Arts Festival, early 1991, I think it was.
No, it was 1990.
Okay, 1990.
I remember that because we came back here to South Africa from exile in 1990, August.
Your memory is better than mine, you see?
Well, it's because it touches my life, you know, directly, because I remember the excitement of my going to Grahamstown because I had not been in South Africa for 27 years. And the Grahamstown Festival invited me, and here I was coming to South Africa. The talks had started. You know, there was all kinds of political negotiation preparation, and we had not officially returned to South Africa as only the leadership that was working with the leadership here was here in South Africa. We were still I was based in Zambia. So there I took a plane from Zambia to come to South Africa. And it was just, it was not the way I had thought I would come back to South Africa. Back to South Africa.
In what sense?
In the sense that I had always imagined that, you know, we would be at the airport and the place would be full of people and streets would be lined with people cheering our return. And somehow, you know, I mean, that's how I had imagined all those years. I think many of us saw it that way, that we would come back in triumph. We didn't think that we would come back in the manner that we did, which was quite bureaucratic. You know, people's names were taken and they came in plane loads here. There was most of the time they were met only by ANC officials at the airport. And then distributed all over the place because we didn't even have formal places to live. So, yeah, it was very low key. I mean, you know, there I was on the plane alone, changed flights here in Joburg, had no clue about how I would be met. Would the secret police be there to question me? You know, I mean, it was just... Yeah, but it was just a smooth plane flight, and I was met in PE, and then I went to Grahamstown. And I remember that I spent one of the coldest nights of my life in Grahamstown.
It can be so cold in that place. I remember wearing every piece of clothing that I had brought with all at the same time, basically. And someone at the airport had stolen my coat. So there I was wearing two jerseys and three shirts and a hat.
Yeah.
And it was like being in Norway in the middle of winter.
Yeah, it was freezing. I mean, at night I couldn't breathe. The air was so cold. But anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, I went back. You know, I went back to Grahamstown last week before last. Because the Rhodes University honored me with an honorary degree.
Well, that's very nice. We're going to take another station break, if you don't mind. Don't go away. We're speaking with Barbara Masekela, who is telling us about the coldest day she ever spent in her life in Grahamstown, Makanda. And we'll be right back. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. And just a word from sponsors and the station ID. Yada, 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 yada. 3, 2, 1. And this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. And today's guest, I'm delighted to have Barbara Masakella, old friend, dear friend of ours, who's had an extraordinarily interesting life in the U.S., in other parts of Africa, in South Africa. She's now doing volume 2 of memoirs, I gather, at the Johannesburg Institute for Advanced Studies. And we were talking about the books that mattered, the intellectual forebears for her of the African-American experience. If you were to recommend to young people, that is people who, you know, who are not our age, books that they should go off and read now, what would you put on that list?
It would be very difficult because I think that there has been such an explosion, I would say, of publication. I mean, increasingly, the world has come to accept the contribution of people of African descent in every discipline. And as such, there has just been a burgeoning, you know, not to mention Asian writers. So yeah. I think that one of the things that I really appreciate about Quincy Troup is that at that time, he was already teaching what he called third world literature. Do you remember that term, third world? There is a world of new writing, you know. Of course, I would let, for me, one of the greatest African classic is a book that is very little known, and it's called God's Bits of Wood by Usman Sembene. Have you ever read that book?
I have not, and now you're going to make me go to the bookstore. Okay, I'm off today to the bookstore.
It is the story of railroad strike in Senegal, but it is also a story of community, of families, of the growth of consciousness. It's a class. It's one of the best books I've read in my life.
Did you read it in French or English?
It's been widely translated into English. It's available in English, and it is written by the great Senegalese filmmaker called Ousmane Sembene.
I'm more familiar with his film work than I am.
Yeah, he wrote a wonderful book. Yeah, you must read that book. Your education is incomplete without that book.
You're driving me to the bookstore. I will. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. We'll be back in just a minute.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is the concluding moments for The Deep Dive with your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, I'm so delighted to have, Barbara Masakella, two-time ambassador to France, ambassador to the United States, exponent of and dedicated purveyor of the new in literature, and an encourager for young people to read widely, deep, and broadly. And just as in a couple of closing minutes, because time is going to run against us, your thoughts on the current political situation with South Africa. You don't have to betray secrets, and you don't have to do anything that will get you.
I think that, you know, it's a very difficult time. It's a very difficult time politically, economically, and it's a globe. It's not only a South African phenomenon, but it's a global phenomenon, which sometimes we tend to forget in South Africa because we are so weighed down by practical problems such as water and lights and what have you, roads and what health, all of those are facing us. But I'm looking forward to exercising my right to vote. It's such an important thing to me because the first time I voted was in 1994, and I was 53 years old. I had never voted before.
Where did you vote?
I voted in Mid Annandale, in the south of Johannesburg, because my grandmother lived and died there. She's the one who raised me, and she had just died 5 months before. And I thought that I would go and vote there on her because born in 1887, she had lived as a child through the Anglo-Boer War, what is called the South African War now. And I just thought that I should go and vote for her there. And it was interesting because I had been working with Mr. Mandela and the ANC, and the ANC offices were deserted because everybody had gone to vote at their station, you know. And for the first time, it was a time of transition, you know. It was a time of transition when we were moving from being a liberation movement into being into political power. And it was an interesting and painful period, but no, joyful. It was a joyful period. This is not such a joyful vote, but I am urging people to go out there and vote and make a difference, because we all fought very hard for this vote and we must exercise it.
When you say 1994 and voting, my wife voted for the first time in a South African election at the South African Embassy in Washington. It was filled with people, everybody giving each other high fives, and amidst the apparent chaos, ballots were being handed out, people were voting.
Yeah, so it's not time to say, but what if, what not, what? It's time to vote. This is what this whole country has been for centuries. Black people were not regarded as equal. And how can we now stand back and think of our little hostilities, pettinesses? We must vote and make sure that we make the change that we want, because we, as someone else has said, it's the change that we can make. We can make that change. And I don't know who told us that we are different from other human beings and that we should not have to suffer the pains and problems that all human beings have suffered, you know, with certain political changes that take place, you know. We have to face it. Whatever is going to be the outcome, we have to face it. And we have to think in terms of other people who do not have the opportunity that we have. We are so lucky to be living in peace. We may have high crime, we may have this, but we live in a peaceful country with a certain amount of stability. And we have wonderful people who are outspoken, and we have so many parties to choose from. And it's our right to choose, to say who we want to vote for. And we must go and have our voices heard. We must vote.
Unfortunately, I'd love to talk to you for hours more, but time has now run against us. I have to say thank you, Barbara. We've been speaking with Barbara Masekela, whose closing words should certainly be plastered all over posters all over this country to encourage people to get up, get out, go vote, make the changes they think are necessary. It's a stirring call to, not a call to arms, but a call to votes. Barbara, thank you very much. I do appreciate your time, and we'll talk soon. This has been Brooke Spector. with the deep dive. We'll be back again next week with yet somebody else that will be interesting, informative, thought-provoking, wise, and funny.